G'day, welcome back to English History, Fact and Fiction, episode the 219th. Ah, it's the Battle of the Grave Lines. Ho-hum, my name's Nick Newman, let's get on with it. Bit of Schubert there, string quartet 13, Allegro, meaning with pineapple on top. Last time we brought everybody nicely up to date, almost. The date we want everyone to be at is the 29th of July 1588, with the Armada in a bit of disarray following the fireships incident at Calais. We need to get the star of the show up to that point, the star of course being our Gloriana Queen Elizabeth I. Betty, that star. Good friend, formerly toy boy, Robert Dudley, has been missing from the episode, so let's just check in what he's up to. And if you're guessing shit fuckery, then well done. The anti-Catholic sentiment had been ramping up, and we have a case that looks entirely fabricated by Dudley. He will capture one guy, Somerville, who was allegedly on his way to murder Betty. I say allegedly because we have torture going on with this guy. He will say his priest, Hall, put him up to it. Now Somerville will be found dead in the slammer. Verdict is suicide. Strangled himself. Yeah, right. More like we don't want him on the scaffold saying it's a bullshit charge. Bring in the priest Hall for a tickle up in the torture chamber and he will say Somerville's father-in-law Arden knew about Somerville's plot. Dudley hates Arden. No trial for Arden, who can just go straight for that nasty, hung, drawn and quartered death. Hall, who provided the evidence, will be put on a ship out of England. We won't be hearing his evidence. Dudley can now score Arden's lands. Now, Arden's brother-in-law was that Nicholas Throckmorton, our ambassador. He's recently died. Once again, we find suspicion of poison, and once again, Dudley is the chief suspect. Just for fans of the movie Betty the Golden Age, it was his nephew, Francis Throckmorton, who was involved in a plot to kill Betty, and he certainly was tortured and went on to the nasty execution. And he was the cousin of Bess Throckmorton, who will soon be marrying Walter Raleigh. The point is, it's a bit of a police state. If you're with the in crowd, it can be easy to get rid of your enemies. Catholics are getting noisy about this torture business, so Cecil will write a declaration of the favourable dealing of Her Majesty's commissioners appointed for the examination of certain traitors and tortures unjustly reported to be done upon them for matters of religion. Yeah, I think he's going to say it's enhanced interrogation, it's not torture. It's about lots of what you're getting is fake news, this book. Nobody gets tortured over points of religion. No, we don't do that. We might torture them about treason, but not religion. Nobody goes straight on the rack, and we only do it when there's already evidence. Yeah, good on you, Cecil. The English know that torture is actually illegal in England. That Edmund Campion had been executed as a Catholic. A Jesuit named Parsons got away. He'll write a book, Leicester's Commonwealth, Leicester being Robert Dudley. It's a smash hit, all about what a total turd Dudley is. People all over England are buying it, and I think Dudley's opinion polls would be total trash. Betty will try to ban it. In her ban, the book letter, Betty testified in her conscience before God that she knew in assured certainty that the books and libels against the Earl to be most malicious, false and scandalous, and such as none but an incarnate devil himself could dream to be true. She'll go on to say it's an attack on the government. No, it's not. She'll get into hyperbole saying she knows all the councillors know that Dudley is a top guy, and she knows for a fact that each and every item in the book is wrong. Yeah, might have gone too far with that one, Betty. Clever guy, Philip Sidney, will write in support of Dudley. But his response is piss weak, because Dudley most likely did most of the things he was accused of. Sidney will decide not to publish it, but it stayed in his papers for future generations to read. That police state will also sweep up Philip Howard, Earl of Arundel, who wrote a long letter saying England is a shit place with the axe against the Catholics and he'll do a runner. The letter will be found in time to nab him on the ship before it sailed. He'll spend a long time in the tower and prove the point that putting guys in a slammer for their belief will just reinforce how important their belief is to them. In the year I'm supposed to be, 1588, he's been caught praying for Phil to succeed in the invasion. That's treason, mate. He's on death row, but Betty will never sign the execution warrant. Nobody will tell Philip Howard that, so he can just live in fear, thinking, is this my last day every day? All in all, he'll do 10 years before he scores dysentery and dies. While he's dying, he'll ask Betty if he can see his wife and kiddies. It'll be only if you do the Protestant magic show, mate. So he'll die alone in the slammer. Now, the latest Earl of Northumberland, Tom Percy, had been suspected of being in the Northern Earl's Rebellion, but was acquitted. We'll keep an eye on him, and the council will decide that he needs to be brought to the tower. In he comes, no trial. Eventually, the public will be told another prisoner gave evidence under torture that Percy was a bad, bad boy. Guilty of treason, but the Earl committed suicide, this time by shooting himself in the heart. These Earls are supposed to be our top military guys, but they're being thinned out. Still, we still have mighty heroes like Philip Sidney. The Prince of Orange had been assassinated, so the Flemings appealed to Betty. She appointed Philip Sidney to go and help out, but Dudley said, fuck that, it should be me who leads the troops. So Philip Sidney will have to be number two. He can go to Flanders then and do really, really well, but he'll be killed. 35. Sad. A literary talent with a handy military type. Now Philip Sidney had a sister, Mary, also a literary talent, who will rework some of his stuff. Dudley has a lot of young nobles following him into Flanders, including his 19-year-old stepson, Earl of Essex Robert Devereux, son of Walter Devereux, the dead Earl, and Lettice Knollys, who Dudley had married. He'll certainly be in the story in a big way soon. Just thinking about another guy we might want to check in on. You may recall that Lady Jane Grey's younger sister married Ted Seymour, Earl of Hertford, without Betty's permission. Betty tossed them both in the slammer, but while in the slammer they had not one but two kiddies. The youngest kiddie died, but the eldest, Ted Seymour, yeah, another Ted Seymour, has survived. Betty sent Catherine to house arrest eventually for the rest of her short life, and she never saw a man again. Now this kiddie, Ted Seymour, had gone to visit nobody Sir Richard Rogers and stayed for the night. Sir Richard's daughter, Honora, may have slipped into Ted's bedroom, allowing Ted to slip into Honora. He's in love, and he just married her. Now you think that Ted's dad, Ted, having married for love himself, would be totally sympathetic. No way. He'll split our young lovers up. Young Ted is under house arrest, but he'll break out and rush to Betty to plead his case. In comes one of his dad's men to arrest him. Young Ted will say, fuck off, you have no warrant. He'll put his case eventually to Cecil, saying, my dad's breaking the law, interfering with my marriage. And he'll succeed. And even Dad Ted will eventually be reconciled. March 1588, and we break off diplomatic relationships with the Duke of Parma. The English know this is a prelude to war and will turn out in their droves. Volunteers will band together. Poor people are asking for hitty thingies so they can belt any Spaniard they might happen to see. Nobles are getting guys together. Rich people are stumping up cash. Anything for the Gloriana. Churchy types will ramp up their anti-Phil and anti-Pope sermons. Some of our best troops are in Flanders. The only professional soldiers we've got in England are the Queen's Guard and the odd garrison here and there, mainly on the coast or the Scottish border. There won't be any allies to call on. Can't trust the Scotties, and there are those Catholics in England who are looking for Phil to win. England's pretty much on its own, but the people are up for the biff. Council will write to the City of London. Hey, guys, what can you stump up for the war effort? London will say, what do you reckon is fair? So the council will say, what about 15 ships and 5,000 hard men? Okay, says London, we'll put up 30 ships, fitted, and 10,000 hard men. This type of stuff will be repeated all over the country. Nationalism is ramping up. Now, some of Betty's advisors will be saying, hey, Gloriana, you need to hide out in the country in case things go pear-shaped. And don't forget that when your dear old dad went to France, he had lots of those prisoners in the tower's heads popped off. Even dear old Margaret Pole. Betty will say, no way. One is cowardice and the other's cruelty. I'm staying around and no head poppings, thank you very much. We will, though, be keeping a very close eye on Catholics and some will be off to the slammer for a bit. She'll say, it's for your own protection, my dear sweeties. If the Spanish turn up, then my Protestants might want to take it out on you. That'll work a treat. Catholics who aren't going to the slammer then will be very keen to prove their loyalty and join in the war effort with a gusto. Some will provide fitted ships and, just to be safe, put Protestant captains and crews in. Guys you can totally trust. We might meet a couple more of the English sailing crew. George Clifford, Earl of Cumberland. Now the Cliffords go back to Bill the Bastard. Royal DNA will get in them when the 7th Lord de Clifford married the daughter of Harry Hotspur and Elizabeth Mortimer. If your memory's going well, you might remember that the Mortimers should have been number one for the big chair when Bolingbroke grabbed it from Dick II. So this Clifford guy had married into the Plantagenet line on the York side of things. Even so, two successive Cliffords will fight for the Lancastrians, both being killed. The younger one was named the Butcher for his murder of 17-year-old Edmund Earl of Rutland, brother of both Ted IV and Dick III. Now that Clifford's widow had to disguise her little baby son as a lowly shepherd boy to save him from retribution. He grew up illiterate because of that. Henry VII will restore the little shepherd boy back to nobility, but that guy won't have much to do with the court. He will do well at Flodden. His son will be elevated to Earl by Henry VIII and will look to marry his son to Eleanor Brandon. They'll have one Kitty, daughter, who will become the mother of Fernando, Earl of Derby. Clifford will remarry and have George, the one who is sailing against the Armada. Now this George had been a ward of Betty, studied under Whitgift, did well in mass, which led him to nautical matters. 1586, and he's fitted out three ships to steal stuff from Spanish Phil. He went but smartly hired a commander who knew the business to run the show. He's also turned out to be a champ of the tournament stuff and will be Betty's champion. Now it's time for him to put down his tournament toys and get on a ship to fight the filthy Spanish, and he'll do well. His actions against the Armada will see him become very confident and he will be off time again on the privateering trail. Also joining the team will be the latest Percy, Henry Percy, 9th Earl of Northumberland, known as the Wizard Earl because of his interest in magic stuff. The last number of Percys have come to a sticky end, so this one smartly joined Dudley fighting in Flanders. Now he's got another chance to show his loyalty. He'll end up being a Gardenite, but he's a Percy, so in future episodes we'll find him in the slammer. Cecil's boys will join in, including Robert Cecil, who will feature in future episodes. This guy was disabled or something and really quite sickly. He'll be a total politics addict, so this is his chance to be noted by Betty. Earl of Oxford, Edward de Vere, who keeps on annoying Betty, will get a ship and go. Sir Charles Blount, back from Flanders, will organise a ship and go. He's another one whose family goes back to the Normans. His granddad had blown most of the family fortune on Henry VIII's stupid foreign war in France. His dad then blew most of the rest of the money looking for the Philosopher's Stone so he could live forever. Charles's elder brother will inherit the rest, blow a heap on hookers and cocaine and die. Charles inherited a miserable 1,000 marks and a title, Lord Mountjoy. But he was young and pretty, so he scored a dinner invite to the court where he was noticed by Betty. He's now got the cash to buy a ship and head out Spanish bashing. Sir Henry Seymour, younger son of Ted Seymour, is already out cruising around Dunkirk with some English and Flemish ships ready to intercept the Duke of Parma, just in case he decides to make a dash for it. There's plenty more, but the point is that the nobles have well and truly turned out in force to seek glory and recognition from the Gloriana. I land our total troops on standby, now tops 36,000 men, with a smaller camp of 24,000 in place to protect London. This all sounds pretty impressive, with the problem that England has had peace for so long that we're short on experience and very short of experienced leaders. Lord Grey, back from Ireland, will be president of the War Council. Lord Hunston, who has experience on the northern border, will command the 36,000 guys. Young Robert Devereux, Earl of Essex, will be the General of the Horse, and Robert Dudley will be given the job of looking after the 24,000 guys to protect London. Given his track record, this is an unpopular decision. That appointment of Dudley is a bit of a flaw in Betty's plan, given that it's the very unpopular Dudley in charge of those 24,000 guys. Betty will smartly decide that they need the presence of their mighty queen to get the morale right. She needs to be a mighty warrior queen like Boudicca, Jane. Except she needs to win, not like Boudicca, who lost. In she comes, riding on a magnificent horsey, wearing a metal suit, with a page carrying a helmet. She's holding a general's truncheon, and a long red wig is flowing in the breeze, and she's going among the common soldiers, who are all cheering with Betty smiling back. We want the speech, don't we? My loving people, we have been persuaded by some that are careful of our safety to take heed how we commit ourselves to the armed multitudes for fear of treachery. But, assure you, I do not desire to live with distrust in my faithful and loving people. Let tyrants fear. I have always behaved myself that, under God, I have placed my chiefest strength and safeguard in the loyal hearts and goodwill of my subjects. And therefore, I am come amongst you this time, not as for my recreation or sport, but being resolved, in the midst and heat of the battle, to live or die amongst you all, to lay down for my God, and for my kingdom, and for my people, my honour and my blood, even in the dust. I know I have the body of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart of a king, and a king of England too. And think foul scorn that Parma or Spain or any prince of Europe should dare invade the borders of my realms, to which rather than any dishonour should grow by me, I myself will take up arms. I myself will be your general, judge and rewarder of every one of you in your virtues in the field. That's going pretty well, don't you think? I know already by your forwardness that you have deserved rewards and crowns, and we do assure you on the word of a prince they shall be duly paid you. In the meantime, my lieutenant general shall be in my stead, than whom never prince commanded more noble and worthy subject, not doubting by your obedience to my general, by your concord in the camp, and your valour in the field, we shall shortly have a famous victory over those enemies of my God, of my kingdom, and of my people. Oh, great. And here we are, nice and ready to kill Spaniards. Dudley, of course, always wants more, 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 more. He'll say to Betty, I should be your lieutenant of England and Ireland, not just lieutenant of this mob. Oh, of course, Robert, with your dreamy eyes, your tight arse and lovely legs. That's no foundation for a promotion. The papers will be drawn up, ready for Betty to sign that Dudley's in charge of everything, but events will take over and that signature will never be signed. Thank goodness. Okay, we've waited long enough. We need to get to the Battle of the Gravelines. Good time for you to go and put on a cup of tea, put your feet up, come back in 5 minutes. Hopefully it'll be done. 29th of July, 1588. Most of the Armada had been scattered by those fireships. The five that kept their heads will weigh anchor to join the fleet and hope they can reform before the English come in. From the English point of view, it's vital to attack while the Spanish are in disarray. Sadly, Admiral Howard won't see that. He's stuck in the English tactic so far. Try to isolate a ship, then have a number of smaller ships hop in and take it down. And right now he's looking at the big prize, the San Lorenzo. Shouldn't be too hard. That was the ship that managed to beach itself in the fireship confusion. It's totally out of action, so he's going to pull 20 ships out of the fleet and go and attack a lame duck. The San Lorenzo is listing, making the cannon totally useless. They're pointing up at the sky. Even so, the English will keep their distance, making their cannon shot useless too. The English will come in and board. The Spanish will nick off, leaving their commander to cop a shot to the head. You may be saying, well, at least they got their ship. How come the Frenchy garrison from Calais are saying, no way, Poms, that thing is on French land, so it's ours. English will say, fuck off. Frenchies will fuck off behind the wall of Calais and start shooting. English will run away. Howard can head into action with the rest of the fleet, but this little foray took about 3 hours, so he's missed about a third of the main action. What a deal. The good news was that Howard's little side trip put Francis Drake in charge of the fleet. Top operator of the Spanish fleet, Medina Sidonia, has his San Martin with 4 Spanish galleons, and they place themselves in a position ready to fight. He's looking to buy time for the rest of the Armada to sort themselves out. He's signalled the Armada to move away, then put his 5 ships in front onto the incoming English. He will get his ships in formation, and that should really scare us off. The Spanish will look to conduct a fighting retreat. It's all about that buying time. On that basis, the English should be looking to maintain their tactics. See if they can isolate one. A bit like wolves isolating a bison. Bugger that, says Drake. He's going in. In they go, blasting away with so much smoke, Sedona will have to climb the rigging to see what's going on. One of the Spaniards, copying it from cannon, will try to get up close to an English ship, any English ship, to board her. English ships, like those wolves, dart away to reform and blast away some more. The decks of the Spanish are filling with the dead and wounded. Masts are shattered, sails are shredded, and hulls have lots of holes in them. In comes another galleon for support, but the English will just hand out more of the same. Those 2 ships then will become isolated and surrounded with the English just smashing them more and more. A third of those 5 galleons has now been hit sufficiently to be sinking. This day was slain Don Felipe de Cordova with a bullet that struck off his head and struck with his brains the greatest friend he had there, and 24 men that were trimming our foresail. And where I and other 4 were, there came a bullet, and from one struck away his shoe without doing any other harm, for they came and plied so very well with shot. And in the afternoon, as I was below discharging my artillery, there was a mariner that had his legs struck off in all pieces and died presently. Many misfortunes have happened. I cannot recount them all. Yeah, that's the Spanish side, and from the English side. That day, Sir Francis Drake's ship was pierced through by several cannonballs of all sizes which were flying everywhere between the 2 fleets, seeming as thick as arquebuses usually are. It is true that his cabin was twice pierced by cannonballs, and there was an occasion in which 2 gentlemen, who towards the evening had retired to rest a little after the battle, and one of them lying upon the bed when it was broken to pieces under him by a saker ball, without his taking the least hurt. And shortly afterwards the Earl of Cumberland and Sir Charles Blount were resting on the same bed in the same place when it was again hit by a ball of demi-culverin, which passed through the cabin from one side to the other without doing any harm other than scrape the foot, taking off the toes of one who was there with them. Yeah, it doesn't sound like the best place to be, does it? Late in the afternoon, the weather will turn a bit squally. The English are again running out of munitions. Time to pull back. The weather is tricky for the Armada. It's pushing them towards the shoals, and weary sailors are working double overtime looking to repair damage, fix holes in hulls, and shorten the sails to keep them from grounding. One won't make it. It's sinking fast. Other ships will send boats to rescue the crew, but only one guy will get off that ship before she goes down. 2 other ships will be driven ashore with the Dutchies rushing out to take them, and about 300 Spaniards will be murdered. Score is 4 ships destroyed, plenty more smashed up, and numbers don't have anchors because the dickheads cut the ropes to escape the fire ships, and there's plenty of dead and wounded. The flagship is in a bad way, said to have taken 200 shot. It's leaking. The wind will change though, allowing the Spaniards to get away from those dangerous shoals. They're heading towards the North Sea, which is also away from the Duke of Parma. The English can just shatter them. Can't really attack because their ordnance supply is too low. Drake will write to Walsingham to let him know how it's going and say he can't wait to get stuck back into the Spanish. Drake, though, isn't that happy. Overall, we've won so far, but five ships gone with perhaps 2,100 Spaniards dead or captured still leaves a bloody big armada. Damaged, perhaps, but we have not won a decisive action. On the very happy side, the plan to meet up with Alexander Farnese, Duke of Parma, has been thwarted. The English action so far has been satisfactory only. They're newbies to this large-scale naval action business. They fail to bring enough ordnance, and their artillery is only good at close range. Their tactics have been ineffective for a big win. They need to learn that close-quarter action is the key. Francis Drake himself had been responsible for any victories. He led the attack at Plymouth, he captured the Rosario, led the counter-attacks at Portland Bill and the Isle of Wight, and led his division unsupported into the Battle of the Grave Lines. Right now, though, it's to be just follow the Armada. The plan now is to chase the Donar up to Scotland, where a couple of English ships can slip ashore to get supplies. Sedona would like to turn back and meet up with the Duke of Parma. His food and water supplies are going off and his guys are getting sick. Drake is guessing that this is happening and will predict that the Spanish will start dying on their way home. While the Spanish are getting sick, so are the English. Only 60 English dead in battle so far, but sickness is likely to kill a whole lot more. We won't get to Scotland before we hit a storm with ships scattered. The naval big dicks are absolutely agreed on one thing. The government has failed to provide support. There will be a strongly worded letter and Walsingham will agree. It wasn't all down to the government. Supply ships had failed to reach the fleet and our guys have been going through gunpowder at a very high rate. It seems that the English are suffering from typhus, so guys will start dying at a rapid rate. Great, says the government. Less wages for us to pay. A lot of these guys were at port, but you can't leave the ship until you've been paid, and the government isn't paying, because more are dying, saving them money. Isn't that great? And because the government are keeping those sailors on the ships, they're eating food that is now rotting, so we're going to get food poisoning. And more sailors will die, and more soldiers will die, more people will die, and it's saving the government money. Drake and Howard are off to see the government to say, this is pretty much shit fuckery. Privy Council give zero fucks.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money.
Yeah, that's the bit they didn't teach me in school. It was all about the brave English defeating the mighty Armada. Drake will pay some guys out of his own pocket. A couple of years down the track and Drake, Howard and Hawkins will found a naval charity. Worse, you bet. Seymour is up Howard for leaving him at Dunkirk while the fleet went off chasing the Armada. Frobisher is up Drake for not sharing the treasure from the Rosario and will even call him a coward. Frobisher is not the only one expressing envy at our hero. Howard is also resentful that Drake is getting all the accolades. Over in the Vatican, Big Papa Pope is talking up Drake as a mighty hero. One Spaniard will be so agitated he'll say how he will kill Drake with his arquebus and start waving that very arquebus around. Loaded, of course, so one guy will die when it accidentally goes off. August and Drake will be called to court. It's about planning a new mission. Howard was not required. He won't be going. He's going to have a big sulk. And Drake is having captured Spanish banners hung on the London Bridge to show off even more. That Armada had kept going north, went round the top of Scotland, then back south, sailing west of Ireland. They'll get separated. One will hit a rock and go down. One survivor only off that ship. Another will run ashore on an island to be murdered by the English there. Some lucked out. Governor of Ulster, Christopher Carlisle, who had served under Francis Drake, will disobey the kill, kill, kill order. He'll actually pay for a ship to take these guys to neutral Scotland. Another ship packed with survivors will just sink. 1,000 guys dead. There will be lots more with lots of bodies washing up on Irish beaches. But let's give 10 points to Christopher Carlisle for saving some guys. The remnants of the mighty Armada will limp home, taking lots of very sick Spaniards. On just the flagship, 180 people had died on the way. Medina Sidonia will be the first guy to get in, and he's going to have to be carried ashore. He will now want to emulate your podcaster with a nice retirement to the country. Smart move. Other mighty sea captains will die soon after returning. As the news gets into England, we'll have more and more celebrations with Betty Eden getting an Armada portrait made. In a first, she'll also have a medal struck, the very first medal ever to be handed out by England. I think those sailors would have rather got their pay and got off those fucking ships. By November, Phil will have the full butcher's bill for his great English adventure, and the news is very, very bad. If God does not send us a miracle, I hope to die and go to him, which is what I pray for, so as not to see so much ill fortune and disgrace. Please, God, let me be mistaken, but I do not think it is so. Yeah, you're not mistaken, Phil. It's a total dud. Just what Francis Drake has wanted for years. This thing had effects on more than England and Spain. Frenchy Catholics have been acting like roosters because Spanish Phil, the biggest rooster of them all, had been on their team. Now he's been totally dusted up. King Henri will be feeling way more comfy. Bring in the Spanish ambassador, Mendoza, who can claim Spanish Phil has just had a mighty victory. Sure, says King Henri. Want me to tell you how many of your ships have washed up on our beaches, or Spanish dead people? And hey, some of your galley slaves survived and we've got them. Mendoza can't spin it well enough for anyone to believe him. Henri will even bring in those galley slaves, Muslims, who'll be going back to Turkey because France and Turkey have a treaty. Henri can tell the Parisian Catholics who'd been calling for him to return to Paris to sit on their own thumbs and spin around. He's off to Blois, taking Catherine and Henri de Guise with him. 8th of September, 1588, and it's the Saturday Night Massacre. Is that a bad reference? Maybe for you, my dear young listener. It goes back to Richard Nixon when the Watergate thing was going badly for him. Saturday, whatever date it was, probably around 1973, and he told the Attorney General to sack the prosecutor of the Watergate case. Attorney General said, fuck you, and resigned. Nixon told the Deputy Attorney General to sack the prosecutor, and he also said, fuck you, and resigned too. Nixon then tried the Solicitor General, who said, oh, okay, and sacked the prosecutor. What Nixon failed to do was to sack the prosecutor's staff, who just stayed quietly in the background getting the goods on Nixon. Besides the point, because we're here for King Henri, who's just sacked all his ministers. The entire lot of them. What the absolute fuck, says everyone. Henri hadn't spoken to anybody. He just did it. Catherine will talk to him about it, and he's got something bad to say about every one of them, and thinks they're responsible for all his problems, and that means Catherine too. Henri will replace them with unknowns, who certainly seem to have integrity, and most important of all, they aren't Catherine's guys. 15th of October, and it'll be the Estates General, and we're all wondering what will happen. King Henri will be on his big chair, with Catherine on one side, and his Grand Master Henri de Guise on the other. King Henri will kick off with a speech about how great Catherine has been, but the tone is like it's a retirement speech. Catherine is definitely out. Henri will finish up with, I am your God-given king. Only I can speak lawfully and truly. Henri will promise to end corruption, stimulate the economy, and run the ruler over taxation. Catholics will want war against the Huguenots, and Henri will say, sure, soon as I can afford it. He'll call on all Frenchies to join him to fight injustice and the troubles of the kingdom. Yeah, it all sounds good. All through this, Catherine had just sat there with a fixed gaze. She may have finally realised that her days of power are gone. Henri is actually being a king. Some great nobles of my kingdom have formed leagues and associations, but, as evidence of my habitual kindness, I am prepared in this regard to forget the past. Henri de Guise will look a tad uncomfortable. He and his brother Cardinal will demand all references to them be removed from the printed version of the speech. King Henri will say, okay. During the sessions, Catherine will be unwell and finally, after 30 years, realise that she definitely has no role to play. 15th of December, and her lung infection is making it hard for her to breathe. But King Henri has heard of a plot that he would be kidnapped by the de Guise and taken to Paris. There's no longer a Catherine de Medici to hop in and chat to de Guise. In comes a musician who had worked a dinner party at the de Guise mansion, and he can confirm that they had toasted Henri de Guise as the next King of France. King Henri will get his favourite assassin and tell him to do de Guise on the 23rd of December. De Guise will get wind of it and be off to see Catherine, who has so often been the buffer between the two boys. Ah, see what I can do, she says. De Guise is being advised to get out of town. 21st of December, and Henri will have an argument. King Henri will call for a meeting of his assassination planning group. King Henri will be saying, either I'll kill de Guise or he'll kill me. The planning group will say, agreed, but we also need to kill his brother, the Cardinal, otherwise he'll come after you. The king's bodyguard of thugs are all in to do the dirty deed. 22nd of December, and Henri will be leaving mass, having another argument. Still, they're both off to see Catherine and can joke around to cheer her up. She'll say, you boys need to kiss and make up. It'll all be the hug and the kissing. I love you, man. No, I love you, man. Crisis averted. Maybe. King Henri will say, hey, buddy, Christmas coming up, but there's a bit of urgent work we need to do first. How about you turn up early for tomorrow's council meeting so we can put in the hard yards and knock some stuff over? De Guise will now get not one, but two warnings that the only business on the agenda in the morning is to make him dead. He replied to both with the same words, oh, Henri wouldn't dare. De Guise feels secure. He's never without a bodyguard, unless he's with King Henri. He also knows that King Henri is a total twat. Now, De Guise will be off for a good banging of his mistress. Well done, lad. When he gets home, it'll be a third warning that he's to be done in the morning. This time he'll just say, oh, that'll never happen. King Henri will ask for an early wake-up call, 4 a.m. Catherine will be amazed. He's a sleeping type of king. He's off to meet with the bodyguard. 5 a.m. and the bodyguard are all in place. It's that one called the 45 because, well, there's 45 guys. Pretty sensible name, really. 8 guys will be assigned to do the deed and 8 guys will be assigned to cut off the retreat and the rest will be on standby. 6 a.m. and it's mass for King Henri. Bit of mass there written by Giovanni Pierluigi da Palestrina about this time. Italian guy. Lovely bit of music, isn't it? King Henri, though, probably should have spent the time reading History of Julius Caesar. That might have been way more helpful. Duke de Guise is up and on his way to see King Henri. A guy will stop him, saying, don't go to the king. It's a trap. Yeah, says de Guise, I've been told that story so many times now, I've lost all fear about it. What a fucking idiot. When the dust settles, we get all the information. It will be a total of 9 warnings de Guise got. Despite the early start request, most of the council will be there by the time de Guise gets to the council. In come the king's bodyguard saying, hey Duke, we need to chat about our wages. King Henri is hiding behind a wall with two chaplains and he's praying. He's asking baby Jesus to forgive the king for what's about to go down. De Guise will be told that King Henri wants a private chat first. Off he goes, and in the antechamber of the king's room are those eight killer bodyguards. They'll raise their hats in salute, but as he walks past, their left hands will go to their daggers. They'll follow De Guise into the king's chambers, and he'll turn around and see that all those warnings were totally fair dinkum. Bit fucking late now, mate. In they go, daggers in and out, repeat, repeat, repeat. Out comes King Henri when De Guise is totally dead and say, "Oh, look at him, King of Paris, not so big now." Oh, dick move there, Henry. And so, my dear listener, it's another case of using assassination to solve the problem. Will it work? Does it ever work? It doesn't. It does not. It never, ever seems to work. King Henri and his bodyguard will go back to the meeting, announce the death of Henri de Guise and arrest the cardinal, brother cardinal, along with any other de Guise supporters. More arrests will follow. Off goes King Henri to Catherine. "Good morning, madame. Please excuse me, but the Duke of Guise is dead, and we shall speak of him no more. I have had him killed to prevent his own plans against me." Okay, back off to mass to thank God for delivering him from evil. "I want to be a king, not a prisoner or a slave." Just a little bit of Christmas mass there, or Christ's mass. Yeah, Christmas mass. To keep King Henri feeling nice and holy. And the reason I put that on is because we come up to Christmas, and on Christmas Eve, Cardinal de Guise will be murdered in his cell. His body, along with Henri de Guise's body, will be chopped up and burnt. No burial site to become martyrs, whatever. Catherine is just asking everyone to pray for King Henri. Like me, she thinks assassinations just make shit worse. New Year's Eve, and a very ill Catherine will manage to go to Mass and visit the Cardinal de Bourbon, who is under house arrest. She'll tell him, "All cool, mate, you'll be safe." He won't be pleased. "It is on your word that we came here and you led us to this butchery." Catherine will boo-hoo-hoo and rush out straight into the cold weather. She's old with lung disease, so that might not have been the smartest thing to do. 5th of January, and she's ready to make out her last will and testament. 1:30 p.m. and 69-year-old Catherine de Medici will breathe her last. Embalming, coffin, message in from Paris. "If you bring a body here for burial, we'll just toss her in the Seine." So, no going off to St. Denis to inter her. Just hang on to her, blah. She will start to stink, so off to a churchyard to go into an unmarked grave. King Henri's illegitimate daughter, Anne of France, will dig her up in 21 years and finally take her to St. Denis. Now, at this stage of the podcast, we've seen five powerful women recently, and perhaps at long last, you might say. While our Gloriana is still alive, her post-mortem will not include anyone else, so this is the time where I want to go where no man should ever go, and that is a chat about our women. We have Mary, Queen of Scots. Her mother, Mary of Guise, who was regent off and on in Scotland, Mary's mother-in-law, Catherine de Medici, the power player, and Mary's two second cousins, Bloody Mary and our own Betty. Can we make any observations? Five women, four Catholic and one Protestant. Four of those women were looking for a policy of moderation on religion, with Bloody Mary being the odd one out, full on setting people on fire. None of those policies of moderation really worked. In Scotland, both Mary of Guise and Mary Queen of Scots were hounded by John Knox for both the moderation idea and their gender. In France, it's been death and mayhem, with neither Catholics or Protestants wanting moderation. For me, it's nothing to do with gender. It's all about nobles wanting to justify belting other people and using religion to do it. Henri of Navarre has been fighting a war for the true Protestant faith while he's converted back and forth about four times. Betty is doing best on the religion stuff, particularly because Henry VIII incorporated religion into the legal code. Even so, it's not working that well with England being a police state. That's never a happy thing for the mob. Well, we'll get to that maybe in Betty's post-mortem. It's not all that bad. All of our five women have been subject to misogyny, even though they would not think that. It's the prevailing condition, and that prevailing condition includes that women need to marry so a man can tell them what to do. Mary Agee smartly refused offers after Jim V died. Catherine de' Medici was a bit past a second marriage when her man died, but she was more interested in power and politics anyway. Mary Queen of Scots made two rather stupid marriages and paid the price. Both Darnley and Bothwell were only ever interested in running Scotland and getting rich. Bloody Mary married Spanish Phil, which was not a great idea. You might recall that he then banged on and on about when he would get a silly hat so he could start making decisions. Now, if a king marries some foreigner, all good. We expect that foreign women will take her role as Queen of England very seriously and put England first, while still working for a positive relationship with her home country. Spanish Phil, King of Spain, put Spain's interests ahead of England's. Maybe that's what Betty saw in deciding not to marry. Marrying a fellow countryman twice got Mary put in a slammer. Marrying a foreigner made Bloody Mary very unpopular when Phil started taking cash and hard men out of England to fight his stupid foreign wars. In these five women, we've seen echoes of our former kings of England. Hardly surprising, previous monarchs have shown the way to rule, good or bad. The only reasonable conclusion is that, so far as running the show goes, there's no difference between the genders. As for the prevailing thought, under the all-powerful influence of religion, a woman is well and truly on the back foot. John Knox was a total fucker in my book, but when he went out bagging Mary purely on gender, nobody said, "Hey, steady up there, mate." Women rulers will be under pressure to marry some man so that he can get on with running the show while she does the knocking out of the ears. It's a shit sandwich, and well done, Betty, for not falling into the trap. Now, the death of Catherine de' Medici should also signal an end to me trying to do both French and English history at the same time. If this were a movie, we'd fade to black and you'd get basic information like King Henri went on to rule France until he finally died peacefully aged 107. He is mourned to this very day, which would be a lie, but you get the idea. You get those little things at the end of the historical movies. But you may sense that we're coming to a change in France that will bring in a new era. So I'm just going to tidy up this Frenchy stuff in maybe more than a couple of sentences. In Paris, the mob will turn out for Henri de Guise's widow and baby. Henri's sister has just moved into one of Catherine's nice palaces, saying, "It's mine now." Paris will turn further against King Henri, who has made an alliance with Henri of Navarre, filthy heretic. The Catholic faction in Paris, though, will now splinter. Henri de Guise had a brother, the Duke of Mayenne, who has zero charisma. He's not terribly bright. He knows nothing about the military, but will say, "I should be king now." France is in chaos, and others will start looking closely at it. Chief among these will be Spanish Phil. Now back to King Henri on the 31st of July, and some monk, one of those dear, sweet, kind, loving and gentle Dominicans, is wandering in. "Oi," says the Attorney General, "what do you want, mate?" "I've got a message for the king from Paris, and hey, look at my letter of introduction." Letter checks out, so in he goes. King Henri does like a nice magical person visitor, so will say, "Sure, come and see me at 8 a.m. Now the Attorney General will have the monk over for dinner, and that monk surely is a great guy. He's even bought his own personal very sharp knife to cut his meat. Next morning, and that monk will be in to see King Henri. No need to search him or anything, he's a holy type. In he goes, and there's the king sitting on the dunny. Yeah, on the dunny. Henri will say, "My brother, welcome. What's the buzz in Paris?" "Secret," says the monk. "Oh, well, come closer so you can whisper it in my ear." Out comes the monk's rather sharp knife, and it'll be right into the guts of King Henri. Henri will pull the knife out and punch that monk right in the face. In come the bodyguards to stab, stab, stab that monk and toss him out the window. There you go. King Henri and Henri de Guise assassinated to solve all his problems, and it's led to a knife in the guts. King Henri is standing there, knife in one hand, while his other hand is trying to put his guts back in. Never a good idea to have your guts on the outside of your body, my dear listener. Surgeons will come in, stuff the guts back in, and sew him up. That evening, King Henri will send out the news that he's been wounded, but he's totally okay and should be better soon. But he's experiencing cold and numbness in his feet. He will summon Henri of Navarre, who will rush on in. By the time Navarre got there, Henri was feverish and vomiting. Henri knows he's fucked. He will take Henri of Navarre's hand and say, "You see, my brother, how my subjects have treated me. Take good heed for your own safety. It is now for you, my brother, to wear that crown which I have striven to preserve for you. Justice and the principle of legitimacy demand that you should succeed me in the realm. You will experience many calamities unless you resolve to change your religion." Officers and nobles in the room will give Henri of Navarre their oath of loyalty. Henri of Navarre will boo-hoo-hoo. Shortly before 4 a.m, King Henri will make his confession, receive the last rites, and die. Now that's the end of the Valois dynasty. It had been kicked off, if you remember, which I'm sure you don't, by Lucky Phil back in 1328, which kicked off the Hundred Years' War because Baby Ted thought he should be King of France through his mum Isabella the She-Wolf. It's lasted 271 years, but now it's gone. It's going to be Henri of Navarre, if he can make it stick. Paris will get the news that King Henri has been assassinated, solving all their problems. Oh, dear me. Hang on, they say, the filthy Protestant Henri of Navarre has been named king. We ain't having it. We heavied King Henri into naming Cardinal Charles de Bourbon as the king. 3 cheers for King Charles X. Henri of Navarre, or new King Henri, will capture Cardinal Charles and have him held by security. A new King Henri will battle for over 4 years against all comers, Duke of Savoy, Spanish Phil, and Big Papa Pope. "I rule with my arse in the saddle and my gun in my fist," that's what he said. Thing is, Paris will hold out. "Oh, fuck it," says Henri, "I'll have to swap magic shows back to the Latin thing." So he will, again. 23rd of July 1593, and Parisians will turn up at St. Denis to watch Henri say the magical words. Sleepy Joe Biden, and he's Catholic again. "Long live the king," yell the mob. "Doing a Latin mass was worth it for Paris," says King Henri. March 1594, and after top secret negotiations to score a general amnesty for Parisians, in comes new King Henri. In come the mob to see him, and they may be disappointed. He's just a man, like anybody else. Catholic propaganda had assured them that he was some kind of monster. You may have guessed that new King Henri wasn't about to give Margot a silly hat. He will initiate an annulment in 1592, with Margot doing very well in the cash settlement, plus she will be called Your Majesty and known as Queen Margot. You might remember all the way back when these two were first married, Bratty King Charles forced Margot to nod when she married Henri, and I did tell you at the time that that might be important in the future. Well, now's the time. She never consented to the marriage, and France is back to Catholic, so all good with baby Jesus, says the Pope. Divorce granted. Eventually, in 1605, aged 51, Margot will return to Paris. Daughter of a king, sister to 3 kings, and nominally a queen herself. She'll be a curiosity. New King Henri will marry Maria de Medici, who is, of course, a distant relative of Catherine de Medici, mother of kings. Now, this Maria is a bit chubby. She's not terribly good-looking, and she's stinking rich. Henri needed the cash. Medici's were his main creditors. She will knock out kitties with one girl, Henrietta Maria, becoming Queen of England. Margot will remain childless, but will be totally involved with the royal kitties, naming the dolphin as her heir. And he's going to get it all. New King Henri will start giving back her old mansions and lands to her. He will even give her a nice block of land in Paris, where she'll build the Palais d'Augustine. It's on the left bank, and it will be Margot who makes that left bank the groovy place. It will become fashionable and attract bohemian musicians, writers, and philosophers. Now, Catherine had died deep in debt, some of her buildings and palaces will be sold off to pay her creditors. At least the ones that Catherine had inherited from her mother are all protected and will stay in the family. Back to Margot, who was wife to nobody and queen of nowhere, so it'll be a series of lovers for her. She'll get a serious toothache and will only be able to eat pureed food. She'll also get to be very large. Towards the end of her life, she will re-find baby Jesus and donate large sums of money, making her the darling of the poor. She'll die in 1615, aged 61. Now, without trying to do spoilers for the future, new King Henri will become one of the most popular kings in France. He'll restore the economy, centralise government, and re-establish a vigorous monarchy. In 1598, he'll crack the right bit of legislation to suit both Catholics and Protestants. Fanatics on both sides accepted. Common smellies of both types were probably well and truly over the civil wars. Henri will be remembered as founding the Grand Century. May 1610, and the guy who benefited from the assassination of the guy who assassinated his enemy will be assassinated. Yes, a Catholic fanatic will do him in. Henri will soften his views on Catherine de' Medici. What could the poor woman do with five children in her arms after the death of her husband and with two families in France, ours and the Guise, attempting to encroach on the crown? Was she not forced to play strange parts to deceive the one and the other, and yet, as she did, protect her children who reigned in succession by the wisdom of a woman so able? I wonder that she did not do worse. I would think that Henri of Navarre has got that just right. Well, it's not what Henri of Navarre thought about Catherine, it's about what you thought of Catherine, my dear listener. Orphaned as a baby, people wanting to kill her when she was just a little girl, off to marry a Frenchy prince who clearly wasn't into her, had to learn how to bang out kiddies, then banged a lot of them out. Apart from Margot, all those kiddies died young, and more than one of them looked a bit insane. The only explanation I have for you is that genetic syphilis theory. Her blind devotion to Anjou, later King Henri III, was a serious flaw. She was an extremely hard worker, always looking to talk things through, except for the St. Bartholomew's Day thingy, but even then she had a go. She was courageous, no doubt about that, and very clever. Good at politics, but might have lacked a grand vision. Those religious wars totaled 8 during her lifetime. 8 civil wars is a big ask for someone in charge, and you have zero hope of long-term planning or looking to fix the economy with that shit going on. Catherine also held firm to a no-burning-humans-alive policy, and let's give her lots of points for that. Catherine was a fan of Machiavelli's work, The Prince, which states, to be a great prince, one must sometimes violate the laws of humanity. I think she got that message. Yeah, a little bit of the Wagaki band with some hot chick playing, what is it? I think it's called the Shamassi, something like that. To get us into some historical fiction. I've got 3 favourite filmmakers and a couple have been mentioned already. Firstly, Akira Kurosawa, and if you ever want to watch King Lear, I recommend watch his movie Ran. Marvel's version of King Lear, and then we had recently Werner Herzog with Aguirre Wrath of God, off looking for El Dorado, and my 3rd favourite filmmaker is Stanley Kubrick. And in 1975, he knocked out a historical movie, Barry Lyndon. It's based on a novel from the 19th century, around about 1850, something like that, by William Makepeace Thackeray. And this movie is just brilliant. It is absolutely marvellous, and I don't care that it's a long way in the future from when it was made, it still stands up. Brilliant movie about a young guy who kind of makes good, and then of course he's going to come down for old common smelly that he is. So if you're looking for something to watch during lockdown, have a crack at Barry Lyndon. But for us, it's just a matter of what we go out with. And golf wraps come back up on the playlist, so how about we go out with a bit of golf wrap and slippage? Hope to see you next week. Bye.